Things have certainly loosened up around here, for sure. Definitely. I mean, I came in, I was so late downstairs. The guy downstairs said, don't even sign. I'll fill the time in for you. What a difference that is.
Yeah, they've been very nice
now. Yeah, oh, my. You can say that again.
I said they've been very nice lately. They just, the other day I came in there, it was a little late, and they waved me right on up. No, body search, no, you know, metal detector, nothing. So
there's a some sort of a knob underneath the console that turns the volume of the earphones down. Does anybody know where it is?
Beats me. I'm a guest here. Well, I have no idea about how to work.
Well, I guess this is Radio Unnamable. My name is Bob Fass, and that is Mike Fader.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It's morning, right?
Yes, it is. That's usually the way we...
I have never been on a radio this late in my life. Never.
And watching the... and there's Hampton. Hi, Hampton.
How you doing, Bob?
All right, why don't you come and sit down?
Thank you.
You know, Mike, I all day long, as I was struggling through your book, I mean struggling because I felt so much of the anguish that went into the life that you fantasized in that book.
Fantasized.
Yeah, and that you can't, I can't actually tell me that that book is a book about your own real life.
I'm really sorry to say it is. I have to say that. In fact, if anybody could prove it's not to get their money back. Anybody bought it. But.
Suppose I can find bits where I'm involved, where I have a different recollection of some of the events.
Well, you're not in there that much. All right. If you can prove that, you get a signed check back from me, a refund of $1. And that's a promise.
But I didn't buy the book.
Well, then, you know,
so
then,
I'm not
then
really
get,
entitled to it.
Then you get a full refund.
Well, it's a really wonderful book, Mike. It's written with such concision, I guess is the word, and such a command of the language. You must have been an English major.
Well, I was a political science major. I was going to be a lawyer. And then I was an English minor, but, you know. But my father said, with that, you'll get a job. And I said, no, you know. But this book, you know, I wrote two books. The first book was 10 years ago, a collection of stories. And it was the first thing. What I did, they were just transcriptions from stories I did on the air, basically. But the second one I wrote from scratch. So it's something I really concentrated on, so I was able to write. And I think it's a pretty good book. I just wish it had become an international bestseller, and I was on a yacht now doing this by ISDN. You know?
Well, perhaps after this morning's program it will, Mike.
Could be.
I hardly know where to begin, because I saw so many points of comparison with my own life and so many points of comparison with nothing else I'd ever... I mean, I never read about, and the I don't know how you managed to pull it together into such a concise form. It's years,
the life
years
of the
of
book,
anguish and pain, and you tell the story in a chapter, and you communicate the pain.
It took me, 6 months to write that first draft, and then like another 6 months to get
this
the
this is not your first book.
And second, the first one was a collection of short stories. This was like a whole life, a whole autobiography. So I'm glad it's over with now, because I don't want to ever go back to those places in my life. You know, let's go back to the basement, you know, dig around in the basement again.
The courage of talking about some of the things you talk about.
Better to look it in the face, right, and pretend it's not. Because if you pretend it's not there, it's going to grab you one day, sooner or later, right? I mean, it's got to grab you, and you don't know it's grabbing you. Better I grab it than it grabs me. That's the way it looks to me, so, you know. When I was one of those kids who used to go down to the beach, like the first day in the summer when the water was really freezing, and the way I would deal with it is like run, and, you know, I put my toe in it. I would just jump in it. It's the only, it's the only way. Impulsivity, you know. It's the only way to deal with it, so. But there's only a couple of parts concerning you, which is where I first discovered BAI, for instance. Do you remember that stuff? I mean, you were on so many times, over so many years, but you did play that one song, I thought, 13 times in a row. That's what I talk about in the book.
Well, I perhaps it was 13, perhaps it was 10.
Could have been 18,
I seem to remember that I played two cuts of it simultaneously.
Did you really remember that? Because it could be. I don't know. All I remember, because I have a very sort of occasionally linear mind, but I remember that you played this. It was a song called, now I remember it, White Dove.
The Dove.
The Dove. And it's got all different versions. I've heard it as a cuckoo is a pretty bird, too. I've heard that.
Well, there are a lot of songs about birds.
No, but it's the same tune, and it's sung. So I've heard the cuckoo. Jack Elliott sang The Cuckoo is a Pretty Bird. I heard him do that on that. Did you see that documentary on his life? The Ballad of Rambling Jack?
No, I didn't, but I've...
It's wonderful. You should rent a video of it.
I've seen
it
live.
Have you ever talked to Ramblin' Jack?
Oh, sure.
Yeah?
I knew Ramblin' Jack before I was on the radio.
Has he been... Was Ramblin' Jack on your show?
Yeah, many times. Yeah?
Yeah.
He and Arlo used to come up.
Now, Arlo I remember on your show. Absolutely. Yeah. But not Ramblin' Jack.
But getting back to The Dove...
So I heard
a pretty
this.
Bird.
Yeah. Now I heard you play this song. I thought at least 13 straight times, which is if it's a 3 or 4 minute song.
This song is To Kill the Dove, and it was a song.
Well, the dove dies. I know
about
that.
War. The dove died. The rabbit died.
Yeah, the dove
Nobody
died.
Nobody remembers that. Nobody knows what that means. The rabbit died.
Bill knows. Well, I guess you have to be a certain age. I mean, what do they have, little test tube, blue test tube test now?
Yeah, it's a pregnancy test. The old rabbit done dies, you're pregnant.
Yeah.
How did that work? I mean, what do they do? They inject the rabbit with something, and then if the rabbit dies, that doesn't seem really fair. Is there a rabbit liberation front, somebody we can contact about this?
Well, the rabbits of the world have said that if they could have a human as a test animal, they would.
Well,
like Planet of the Apes.
Mike, is it that all happy families are alike? Or?
I don't know. I really don't know. I mean, I assume...
all unhappy families are different.
Maybe it's a basic assumption that you... I always assume when I'm on the radio, and maybe you assume this too, that if you refer to something that you're feeling... You have to take it for granted that a lot of people listening to you
have had a similar experience.
Or else you would feel like you were completely disconnected. And, I mean, you might as well just be walking down Broadway and screaming out loud like anybody else on a traffic island, right? You have to take it for granted that what you have to say means something because other people have felt it, right? So I, even though my life might have been very extreme, I just take it for granted that other people have had not necessarily similar experiences, but on a continuum, right? And I assume... that most people feel that way. Although I once said something on the air, some guy called up and he said, you know, not everybody feels the way you do about things. So, but I don't believe it. You know, what am I, from outer space? How could I feel something that other people don't feel?
But Mike, you're talking to those parts of yourself in other people.
Yeah.
And when we communicate, which is the highest form of communication, of empathizing in your speech to that other person, what they could have felt, it's never going to be everybody all the time understanding you. But those few is enough.
Well, that's true. That's true. If you get X thousands of people that hear what you have to say, that's plenty.
Yeah.
Except that I think maybe it's part of a certain grandiosity that some people who go on the radio all the time assume that anything they say should be understood by everybody. I mean, there are obviously people on BAI who speak as if whatever they say should be a universal truth, right? I mean, we hear that all the time.
So, yeah, and that's an absolute to them.
Not just on BAI, but on
any station.
Right.
Because they're in front of a microphone. They get no feedback from anybody. They can turn off whoever call them up when they want to. They're in full control. They have the power.
But they get a lot of feedback, too. I mean, let's say if you're on a commercial station, you'll get hundreds, if not thousands, of emails and letters from people who agree with you, and that could go straight to your head, and then you think everything you say is the gospel, right?
I mean, I don't like broccoli either, let's say.
Yeah, but that's what Walter Winch...
But when you write about the experiences, the kind of experiences that you had...
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, well, not people, everybody, you know.
See, Julius Lester once said... what radio is about, as far as I'm concerned, is sharing an experience with the audience. Some experience that the person on the radio has had strikes a chord in the audience or makes them try to imagine what it would be like to be this other person with a different perspective, a different point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes for fascinating radio. You know, you write about Larry Josephson and how he was like God's own curmudgeon. And
well, also he was the thing about Larry Josephson was this is back in the 70s, 60s, and, right, 60s, and then the let's say early to mid 70s was the thing about him was that he had an entire city sort of waiting for him to show up. He would never be on time. And the whole trick was, I swear there must have been 30, 50, 60,000 people sometimes sitting in front of their radios listening to white noise all over New York City. And the whole trick was, when was he going to show up? And, of course, what he had you believing was that one day he just wouldn't show up,
well,
you know? And, but he always did.
As the guy who was here waiting for him some mornings, I wouldn't go off until I heard him at the door some mornings.
But sometimes the station was turned off before him, right?
He didn't come in sometimes. And one particular time, his program used to go off at 9 o'clock. There was a call about 8:58, and Larry said, "I'm sorry, I overslept." And that was the program. We played his theme.
Well, he just I remember that he used to average about half an hour. The show, I think, was supposed to start at 7, and he came on often at 7:30, you know, 7:25. And it always started the same way. He'd be clearing his throat, banging things around in a bad mood, cursing, whatever it was. And then he'd order his coffee. His bagel.
He was hungry for coffee 24 hours a day.
Right.
That's the one thing that I didn't put it. I can't take the smell of coffee.
You don't like coffee?
Mm. It isn't that I don't like it. I dislike it.
Really?
Yeah.
The smell of it really gets
the
me.
The smell of it.
Love it.
When I was aboard ship, you know, the coffee pot is always there.
Yeah.
And I was aboard a ship where the engineers were given 1 pound of coffee for every 4-hour watch.
A pound?
1 pound of coffee. That was on an East Branston ship. We ran from here to India, China, and then back around.
Is that commercial, like a freighter?
It was a freighter.
Yeah.
It was a junk freighter thing. But each watch was given a pound of coffee.
They must have all died of heart attacks when they were 50 or something.
Well, I was the third assistant engineer on the ship. Right. The second engineer who relieved me, he came down with a cup of coffee. He wouldn't sign in the logbook until he saw that I had the other coffee pot ready for him. He would hand me the bag of coffee he had because I never used mine. And all I would do is just keep circulating it. But the guys, I had an electrician, a fireman, an oiler. It was 4 of us.
Mm-hmm.
But can you imagine 4 men drinking that much coffee?
Did they drink a black, too?
Every day. And I
think they rot their insides out. I mean, if I drank black coffee, it would go straight through me like acid, you know?
Well, I had a terrible coffee habit. I mean, it took me a lot of coffee. I mean, I would make a big pot of, like, 10 cups of coffee, and I'd have to drink it before I could begin to face the day.
So you just
no more.
How did you break the habit?
I only need one cup. It's got to be very hot.
But how did you break the habit?
And instead of drinking the coffee to wake up, I just take this one hot cup and I pour it on my leg.
Oh,
and
which one, right or left?
That's me. My sleep is out of the question. You know.
Well, I like the way it tastes. To me, it's like a natural antidepressant. I mean, I drink it like if it's gloomy, like on a winter day, you know, like 4 or 5 and it's gray out. If I drink a cup of coffee.
Was your book fueled on coffee?
Yeah, I drank a cup of coffee every morning before I started writing. But I'm kind of drug sensitive. I mean, some people might need 8 cups of coffee, like you were saying. All I need was about a half a cup of coffee, and that's enough for me. But without that, I drank a cup of coffee before I start writing every morning, so.
How long did it take you to do the writing? 6 months, you said?
It took 6 months for the first draft, but I'm sort of expansive. Manic might be another word for it. They asked me for 300 pages, and I gave them 900. So that was really unfair to the editor. So they had to really whittle it down because I'm not, you know, I'm not writing War and Peace, and I'm not, you know, I'm not mailer. So they're not going to publish a book that long. So it was, that was a problem. So,
well, you're going to do readings from your book.
I did. The book is already history, you know. The book is out of print. It came and went in about 3 months.
What?
Yeah.
You're going to be doing something at the Cornelia Street Cafe.
Yeah, well, that's already, but that's not connected to the book anymore. No, the book is really, if you went on Amazon looking for the book, it'll tell you it's out of print, because there was a couple of reasons for that. One is because I had a really terrible publisher as far as publicity goes. I mean, the bottom of the basement. They did everything possible they could do wrong. And then they brought the book out in the middle of the summer when everybody was basically not around.
Yeah.
So I had all my interviews and I lined up all the publicity, which mostly I got. They didn't get. And it all happened in July or something like that. So, you know, that was a total waste of time. Also, I think there's been a backlash in the last several years against memoirs. There was a lot of memoirs in the last 20 years and a lot of bad ones. I mean, everybody who was writing a memoir for no particular reason or who couldn't write or didn't have much of a life to write about. And so people got a real bad attitude about memoirs. The market was, like, you know, just overstuffed with them. And so there was a backlash for that. And then it was beginning to get a bit of a second wind and the planes hit. And that was that. So I say, lock all those guys up just for that. That's what I say. You know, and there's the ultimate pinnacle of selfishness. But, yeah, so the book actually, and I think it's terrible because as far as I'm concerned, it's a really good book. It got great reviews. It took me a long time to write it and poured a lot of blood and sweat into it. And I feel, you know, but now it took me a few months to get over the bitterness about it because I really wanted to.
You call it the talking cure.
The talking cure. Well, it's still available.
Didn't you get a good review in the Times?
No, I did not. No. What I got in the Times was an interview on those, you know, the People page on the Metropolitan section. So that interviewed me. And the guy decided I was some kind of, he was from upstate, this reporter. And he got a chip on his shoulder about, like, he hated New York. So he decided he met the ultimate self-involved, you know, analysis crazy New Yorker. And he got a completely wrong take on me. And that was sort of like being stereotyped.
He labeled you like a talk therapy session.
That's how it was. Like, I was some kind of mad Woody Allen type, which, you know, but so that was. But publicity is publicity, like they say. So, but it just didn't, I don't know, it just didn't work. It wasn't fated to take off. It's too bad, too, because I think it was really a great book.
Well, I laughed a few times during the book.
Well,
there were more times when I felt, you know, something like anguish, close to tears even, reading about some of the pain that you had.
I'll tell you, you know, there was nothing in that book, really, seriously, there's nothing in that book that's, you know, that's made up, unless, of course, I mean, when I tell a story sometimes, I definitely exaggerate. But that's almost like as if there's if there's live people in front of me, it's a performance. Mm-hmm. So storytellers get carried away. But that book is
okay. When you were manager of WBAI,
well, I was the assistant manager.
You were the assistant manager, but Steve Post was under very heavy sedation.
He was having
in New
lots
England.
Of problems, and I was the de facto manager for a year. That's when I was trying to kill you every time you showed up. Right?
That's right.
Yeah, I was his hired bulldog, and I was trying to bite you every time you came around. I was a loyal guy. That's what he told me to do. You know.
But
is it time for confession?
I wasn't even thinking about that. I was just thinking about the time that you were sitting in your office as you have in the book, and there's a call, one call after another from people who want to get paid.
It was a time when we were as broke, I suppose, as we ever were in the history of the station. It was, in fact, a year or so after 77, after all the trouble in 77. So, and you know much more about that than I ever will. And the station was utterly broke. We had lost a lot of subscribers and lost a lot of listeners. And it was impossible to try to run the place. We couldn't pay the staff. We couldn't pay anybody. I mean, so we had people calling up all day long, threatening to take things up. We had the phone company calling the first day on the job. This is true. The first day on the job as assistant manager at BAI, the phone company said they were turning off the phones, you know, at a radio station, right? And then all day long, they were going to take the air conditioning out. I mean, everybody was being stiffed. Nobody was being paid anything. And it was under my dubious administration that the last person ever got paid to do a show on BAI, and that lasted almost 10 years before they started getting it normalized and were able to pay people again.
That was after the church?
Yeah, that was right after the church. After we moved out of the church. I was at the church for about 6 months. And then Larry could tell more about, Larry Josephson knows more about why we lost that battle. It's a very complicated, like, tax problem and something else. But
the Carlin case.
Well, the Carlin case was a problem for Pacifica, not really for us. I mean, they had insurance and they had lawyers and everything like that. But Of course, a lot of money between the Carlin case, which cost hundreds of thousands of dollars to take to the Supreme Court, and the 77, what would you call it now? A strike? What's the correct word for what happened in 77?
I'd say it's a lockout.
Lockout?
You?
Strike?
No.
I call it the troubles.
Troubles.
I'd call it a specific job action.
Well, so we all have different names, but what it did was turn the station into a total bankrupt situation. Yeah. So working here, we were always from day to day. We would have things. One time we did actually have outgoing phones cut off for one day. I wrote checks that weren't covered by real money. I wrote fake checks until we got the money in. You know, I was spreading bad paper around just to keep the place going. It was awful. And everybody was screaming at me. They were screaming at me from inside the station for everything was going wrong inside. There was no supplies. Nobody was getting paid.
No raises, even.
No raises, jeez. I was getting paid $10,000 a year to be the assistant manager of the place.
You never seen it.
Well, but
no, I never did. In fact, I was left owing $10,000.
The scene that I owed. Objected to was first someone comes in and takes out the postage meter.
That's right.
And then
the city marshal came in and repossessed the postage meter on the first day of the job.
That's right.
And then you hear that the telephones are going to be turned off. And then someone comes in and asks for funding for a woman's concert.
That was a separate day.
That's what I thought.
That was internal disaster.
You see, I recognize that all those things couldn't possibly happen on one day.
I didn't say they did. I didn't say they did. I wrote that book, and you'll be hearing from my lawyer. I'm going to sue the Pacifica Foundation for what you said, and if $3 million, that is nothing after I get through with it.
$3 million?
That's what the debt is, $3 million. According to Leslie Kagan, we owe $3 million.
I thought it was so closer to 3.4.
Well, that may be. I'm just at least 3, though. Yeah. 3.4, maybe that's it. What she'll probably try to do is get a lot of the creditors to forgive the debt or write it off as a bad debt. And she may be able to do that because...
Well, it could be tax exempt.
There were no books kept during the last year.
Well, so when she says she has the auditors down in Washington now looking at the books, they're not going to be any... There's nothing to look at?
Well, Earl Maitland
went down for that. A couple of receipts from Kmart, maybe. And
also maybe from the Brazil tourist agency. Isn't that where Bessie Wash is now? I've been told she went to Brazil, and that's very interesting, considering the fact that there's a lot of money missing. I have no idea.
Down there also, though.
I don't know. I mean, I hear that she's fired, and then I hear that the place is broke, and then I hear that money is missing, and the woman's in Brazil. But maybe she'll be back soon to tell us all what happened to the money. I don't know. Somebody knows what happened to the money. Unless, of course, it's utter incompetence and they just mismanaged it. I mean, the place was mismanaged so badly that you begin to think that they couldn't be that stupid and somehow the money found its way someplace. But what's happening now is that Leslie Kagan, who's the chair of the Pacifica Foundation, now has, at this moment, auditors down in Washington going over the books. And she even suggested herself that they may find, for all they know, some malfeasance. So I have no idea what went on.
That's a deliberate act, though.
Yeah, absolutely. So I don't know. There's no way of knowing what happened.
Ignorance is one thing, but malfeasance is saying a person is doing something specifically for a gain.
Well, it may have happened. I don't know. So we're with, and after all, in our local situation, if you took BAI as a separate entity, I'm sure that we, over the course of the last year with Utresa and her gang in charge, we probably lost $1 million alone just at this station in income. That's a lot of money. And also this $1 million, which they claim they raised during the last fundraising drive, I'll believe it when I see it. But since nobody here anymore was allowed to look at the books, to have a tally, to have any idea how much money came in, who could possibly believe that? I think it's completely inflated. It's probably more like $500,000.
I put in at least 3 or 4 days a week during that drive. Mm-hmm. And I'd put in 6 hours, 7 hours. But I would refuse to sign in because I just can't see this here identification sign in. I'm not in a prison. I mean, the station, when I first climbed up those 3 flights of stairs, Bob. You remember that?
You're talking about 39th Street.
Yeah.
I was there one time.
Well, I was there for a number of times.
I didn't like being there at a certain point because the Vera Foundation shared the building with us. And you'd pass these young district attorneys with their guns on their hips. And then I read this part in your book where you talk about how you fell in love with your gun.
Oh, and I love being a probation officer. Yeah. I had a badge, I had a gun, I arrested people. I had the time of my life. I mean, I love being a cop. I have to admit it. And I like guns. I love guns.
I found out.
That's very bad for BAI.
I found out, and I was a weapons master, hear me? And I used to practice on a range on 9th Avenue. Remember the
Oh,
Olympics?
Yeah, I know that one. Yeah.
Well, did you know that the SWAT team practiced there? Did you know that the Olympic rifle team practiced there?
Oh, really?
And they instructed me until I got proficient enough to put 10 shots inside of a dime at 300 feet. That's 100 yards.
And did you ever put that to use?
No. I stopped hunting then.
Hunting that, what?
Anything.
What were you hunting before?
Deer, rabbits, squirrels, crows.
Your karma is going to suffer for this.
No,
little animals.
No.
You murdered little animals.
Yeah.
I can't believe,
Yeah.
Are you wearing any of them right now?
No, the last polar bear club thing, I lost that. You know, I had a claw as long as my middle finger from a Kodiak bear. I didn't kill it, but I had the documentation that this was a ton and a half bear, 3,000-pound Kodiak bear. It was killed back during the time of Roosevelt and them, a big white polar bear. And the guy gave me the claw, and the documentation said that it could knock down a 10-inch tree with a swipe.
Jeez. We had people like that here right before
a couple of
Saturdays.
If you can shoot that proficiently, do you think it's hunting to kill something? 300 feet, though.
Mm-hmm.
And you can put 10 shots inside of a dime.
Yeah.
Where's the sport?
Well, where's the sport in anything? I mean,
well, you miss once in a while, it's one thing.
Oh, I see.
You're
taking
a chance like you're playing bingo, you know?
Well, right, but the rabbit doesn't shoot back. That would be sport.
That wouldn't be sport.
Let me ask you a question. You got the TV on there. Is there a reason for that? Because it's driving me out of my mind. I mean, we got a TV on in the studio, but if you usually have it on, that's all right.
No. Why don't we turn it on?
Can we turn it off?
Yeah, they leave it on normally, but...
I always turn it off because it distracts
me. The remote vanished, so that...
Well, I think they leave it on to get the up-to-date weather a lot.
And I never look at it.
No, it's just distracting.
I don't see that.
Great. That's
great.
TV is gone. This is the radio. We don't need a TV here. So,
you had a TV and you put it in your closet.
I put it in my closet because I was addicted to it. You know, you can get addicted to TV, right?
Not me.
Did you ever have a TV?
I've got about 5 of them now. I do video work. And I do not watch television.
Wait a minute. How could you do video work and not watch television?
I do the videoing.
So you don't watch regular TV, you mean? Like nothing, cable?
I do documentary. I do the stuff that people are supposed to get some truth out of.
So where do you show this stuff?
BMCC, you know, down here at the Manhattan neighborhood.
So you have a video camera?
It's right out there.
Do you have your own show? What do you?
No, I just do it with. I do it with the sound gatherers. I do it with Minister Clemson Brown. I do it with the sound gatherers, Melvin Simmons and stuff that was started with Samuri. And Bernard White here. And why I got into it was to find out how the hell could a man destroy an automobile union, get rid of the air traffic people, bust down the steel industry, and still get elected with such a great majority of people.
You're talking about Reagan. Right?
Who else could I be talking about?
Mm-hmm.
So I had to go back and understand to myself, back in the 80s, how could this image be projected? And that's how it was done, with television.
80,000 pages of secret documents from the Reagan administration are classified indefinitely.
Now, how does he get the power? How does Bush get the power?
Television.
Wait. How does he get the legal power to say that government documents, which theoretically belong to all of us, are not to be looked at? How does he get that power? I thought Congress would have that power.
Stroke of the pen. Executive order. Executive order.
But the presidency is much too strong. In the last 30, 40 years, I guess after Roosevelt, it just got stronger and stronger, right?
Eisenhower warned you, didn't he?
You think that's anything? You should see the Village Voice this week about Giuliani. Giuliani took all the city council video and audio tapes, records.
Did he really?
Put them in the fortress, right?
And
all of them away to a Queen's White House, and he won't let anybody see them. And they're all created with public funds.
Well, that's because it's got all these notes to Judy Nathan in it.
You know about Giuliani, what he's trying to hide, just what the Kennedys were trying to hide. His father there was a stick-up man up in Harlem during the Depression and started a year and a half in Sing Sing prison.
Well, I think he mentioned that finally.
Yeah, but did you know that his cousin got shot dead on Staten Island by an FBI agent because he was trying to kill the FBI agent? And the other cousin got arrested about a month or two ago what do you call it, trying to stick up a $9 million payroll to the New York Times?
Well, that's not Giuliani didn't do that. Well, I'm more concerned about the fact when he dressed up as Marilyn Monroe that he enjoyed it too much. That's what I'm concerned about. I mean, the guy, and, you know, God bless him for that, but, I mean, his identity should be more certain if he's the mayor. That's what I think.
You look
cute. Somebody said that.
You're on the air.
Yeah.
Well, last night I had the strangest dream I ever dreamed before. I dreamed the Utrecians had once again taken the station away from us once more. Bob!
Hey,
Captain.
Yes.
Mike Fader. First.
Who is this?
This is Jeff, Mike. How you doing?
Hey, Jeff. How you doing?
Unbelievable. Hey, Bill.
Hey, Jeff.
All right. So, I just want to say this. Mike, this is addressed to Michael, because he's the only one that's in returning to speak about the anti-Semitism, and not to focus on it now, but at some point in the program tonight, you might make a specific statement about that general and, you know, problem which you feel has happened to be in the past year especially, but as you said, the past 10, 15 years. I don't mean to get heavy all of a sudden, and I won't. I'll say, I can't believe we got it back, man. I will get heavy for 1 second. When you mentioned that $3.4 million debt, my blood boiled so bad to think about how they just...
And let me tell you something. Hold it. It only took them a year to do it, too.
One year
they did that.
With the local money, you're saying there were no books kept by Utrecht. Is that what you're saying? Or the
well, that I don't know.
In a way, it was like one of those 1930s movies where somebody inherits a large amount of money and they don't get to keep it unless they can spend $1 million in a year.
Well, the situation was this.
Hulk, they have a dime in my pocket. Oh, I got to get rid of this last dime.
It's one thing we could laugh with that, but they're still...
I'll tell you what happened. About 2 years ago, the Pacifica National office decided to take away all the local control of money by the station managers. So around 2 years ago, so no one at a local station has had control over check writing.
Yeah, so we're not
going to
use trees for this, then.
She had no control over the money, so you really can't blame her for that.
Okay, all right.
You can blame her for anything else, but
everything
not for that.
Everything else.
Now, those balloons.
The balloons, that's true. Well, actually, I mean, if she wanted something, she asked Pacific, and they gave it to her.
The balloon budget was all inflated.
I guess the thing that hurts the most, this was said dozens of times, but it can be said a few hundred more, I think, was that, you know, if you were against her, you were racist. Never mind that 45 of the people, you know, of the producers were African-American or people of color. But that whole thing that went down was the ugliest thing that... This crisis so surpassed, Bob, the 77 thing and
Bob, do you want to take offense at this? Because it's one of the great moments of your life, so you know.
Well, no, the big difference was that there was no real organization or solidarity in 1977. In this past period, there were listeners groups who had seen what had happened in 1977. Producers who had seen what had happened at other stations. And there was the Internet, was a phenomenal way to organize.
Which we would not have had.
In some ways, the Internet took over the radio station.
That's right.
And
bested
the radio station.
Well, including BIX, too, which was the Internet broadcast.
Yeah. Right. And Radio for Houston.
Hey, the Manhattan Neighborhood Network with Bernard. Mm-hmm. Those broadcasts segments up there.
Well, there is something I might want to talk about later if you want to talk about. And it is having to do with Jeff brought up. It's like... He said, for instance, he's so happy we're back. And we were at the local board meeting. Bob, you were there with me the other day. And we were at the local advisory board, the lab meeting the other day, which was held at the station for the first time in something like a year. And there was this chant, which I understand a lot of people who were protesting and a lot of people at organizations were chanting, "Whose station? Our station. Whose station? Our station." Mm-hmm. And I kept thinking, who is our? Who is us? Like Jeff just said, I'm so happy we got it back. Who is we, and what do we have back? And that's a whole other discussion.
Well, you know, it's a question of a kind of a civility and a respect for the listener that disappeared. No,
yeah, but when did it disappear? You think it just disappeared in the last year? I don't think so.
Well, from time to time in the past, I can recall it disappearing, too, and coming back. But
I hung up on you a couple
of times.
You know
what? Every time someone says that, I feel like I want to say, well, you know, whose station, our station, you don't really own a radio station. It's like a Piaget watch or something like that. You only take care of it for whoever gets to have it in the future.
But you're just a fiduciary, Bob. You're just passing through what has been entrusted to you.
You're on the radio.
Hi, good evening, Robert. We've gone through another mess, baby. Anyway, and we're still here. Like that great song in Follies, we're still here.
So anyway, you went through the whole 77 thing, huh?
Oh, 70? Are you kidding? Bob and I go back to the 60s.
Would you like to explain how?
Well, I guess I'm the third person Abby Hoffman called up before Yippie was started. But anyway, I decided to channel Mae Brussel tonight. And that was a late.
It's not the first time you've done that, and
I
you
know.
Do it very well, actually.
Thank you. you do very well.
Poor May, that was an awful fate she suffered, huh?
Hmm. Well, horrible.
Anyway, every once in a while they would call her paranoid, so I'll throw this in. You mentioned that this lady has disappeared to Brazil.
Well, that's what we've been told.
Yeah. Okay, where there is no extradition.
Yeah, that sort of seems...
no extradition for financial
right.
stuff.
And also, it seems that in the current copy of the Lowdown by Hightower, he mentions how far back this whole thing, which of course the conspiracy theories are, that this is all about... A World Trade Center is all about building a pipeline under Afghanistan. Now, if you're going to decide to have a war and you're going to go back that far, what's the first thing you're going to think about? Well, we don't want any of these serious war protesters like we've had in the past. And what is this station famous for? So maybe, just maybe, you infiltrate a station like this. And you disrupt it and you ruin it.
Well, I've heard a lot of people say that, and I don't think that's impossible at all. First of all, let me say before I say anything else that I am not saying that Miss Bessie Wash has stolen so much as a penny. I have no idea. I don't want to be accused of libel or slander or whatever it is. All I know is she was fired. There's a lot of money missing. These are facts. And she went to Brazil. Maybe she's back from Brazil. I don't know where she is. But I am not saying, very clearly, not saying... that she did anything wrong. I mean,
I'm not even talking about her. I'm just talking about...
Well, I'm talking about me. I'm protecting me right now. You go right ahead.
I'm just talking about the whole way this thing turned out, that the top people, the most interesting people at this station, people like Bob Knight, people that had an audience that we really, you know, people really loved over the years, suddenly disappeared, okay? As far as I'm concerned, this was a deliberate way of ruining the station. She created, I'm talking about your trees now, she created a conflict there that this, what this whole station stood for, suddenly dissolved. I mean, when Amy Goodman and Bernard White, I mean, that was it for me. I don't believe it.
Well, let me explain the interior conspiracy theory here, which was not very well spoken of, I think, over the air, because we all got, you know, bounced if we were to say anything, but... Here's what a lot of people down here assumed what was going on, and I think there was ample evidence for this, and I'll explain why. A lot of people assumed, and it's based on what you just said, that people like Bessie Wash and the way the Pacifica Foundation was bankrupted and taking somebody like Utrice, essentially the idea was to wreck the finances of the whole place, put it so deeply in debt that there was no other course but to sell the stations off and get hundreds of millions of dollars. And guess what? The people... who were on the board of directors were radio station brokers, accountants, and lawyers. Is that a coincidence? Can you imagine? We had a radio station broker on our board of directors, and all they had to do was go to the FCC and say, look, we're about to go bankrupt. We have to sell off BAI, or we have to sell off whatever it is, and get $100 million to keep going. And he would get, you know, $10 million of that at his cut. So that's no conspiracy. I think that's as clear as day, you know.
Well, I'm just using Mae Brussel's theory, okay?
Well, I mean,
if she was alive today, she would be saying, what's this got to do suddenly with this war? And the fact that this is... Do you know that there was a book by, Stanislav Brzezinski, unpronounceable name, a Secretary of State under Carter.
Zbigniew Brzezinski.
In 97, he wrote a book saying that we would have to, you know, maybe even go to war over this, in order to build this pipeline, in other words, the globalization theory, etc. So this has been in the works for a long time.
Well, also, I could buttress your theory here by the fact that Marion Francis Berry, who was the person who actually started this whole corporatization and right-wing movement in BAI around 1995 or 96 was a good pal of Bill Clinton's. And everybody assumed that the centrist, that is to say the conservative branch of the Democratic Party, was trying to co-opt the Pacifica Foundation, and I have no doubt that that's true. You know.
And remember that letter that was sent inappropriately to the wrong person?
Oh, that's
Michael Palmer's email.
Right? Yeah, that letter
spoke
specifically of setting the pattern to dispose of those stations.
Yeah, and I think that's all very... And you know,
I'm always accused of lingering in the past.
Well, I think that's because it's true, but you should defend yourself.
You want to bury it, Bob?
Is that like wallowing in the 60s?
Why don't we...
Bob, you want to bury it?
Why don't we move on to the future?
Okay, I'll say goodnight.
No, don't go away.
Why don't you channel something from the future? That's I guess we get a long pause.
Did you say channel the future?
Yeah. Why don't you channel something from the future instead of the past?
I am not. I'm sorry to tell you, I am not optimistic. But I will say this: it is very interesting to me now that they are making things so miserable. This, I'm not going to tell you anything positive because I'm very negative about what's happening in the country.
It's okay. I took my antidepressant.
And we're going to have a cleansing down here at the station, you know.
Well,
I'm not thinking
about the station as much as I am that this situation at the airports, that they are deliberately making it so miserable for travelers that people are going to be willing to give up their civil rights and do anything, give their fingerprints, give their iris prints, whatever, to have a card in order to travel. And that's the beginning, folks.
Yeah, well, look what Ashcroft is doing. Except that, you know what, maybe in the end, Enron will save us all. I don't know.
Well, that's another thing that fascinates me, is that no one is talking about the fact that Citicorp, which has an enormous amount of Saudi money in it.
Been lauded.
Yes, and is in very serious trouble. In other words, and nobody, they won't make, all these wonderful channels that the money shows.
Right.
Nobody will make a statement about how much money they've got in South America. I mean, Argentina's in trouble, Brazil is tied to Argentina, etc. And if Citicorp goes, man.
Find that book, Red Herring, that magazine about a month ago, which gives you the whole expose as to who those people are with bin Laden and the connections they have. That's a hell of a book. I don't know how they printed it.
While we're looking for the book, I want to play a song that's dedicated to the first 10 amendments.
Good night, Bob.
Slip sliding away. You know the near your destination, the more you slip sliding away. Slip sliding away. You know the near your destination, the more you slip sliding away. Just might disappear, but right now I'm slip sliding away. Slip sliding away. You know the near your destination, the more you slip sliding away. I know a woman became a wife or helpless. These are the very words she used to describe her life. But she said, good day is the day I ain't got no pain. But she said, a bad day's when I lean back, just think about things it might have been. But right now, Lord, I'm slip sliding away. Slip sliding away. You know the near your destination, the more you slip sliding away. Tell him the reason for the wrong you done. came a long way just to explain. Just as Sunday lay sleeping, then turn around, headed home again. He said, son, I'm slip sliding away. Slip sliding away. The more you slip sliding away, Lord have mercy. God only knows.
God only knows.
God makes his plan.
God makes his plan.
Can't submit to the will of God. Every day you work your job. Friday collect your pay. Lord, you think you're sliding down the highway when in fact you're slip sliding away. Slip sliding away. Slip sliding away. You know the nearer your destination, the more you slip sliding away.
You're on the radio. Hi.
Good morning, gentlemen. Two of my favorite radio personalities. This is Gary from East New York.
Well, hi,
how
Gary.
How you doing, Gary? What's happening?
Well,
nice seeing you the other night.
Yeah, well, that's the whole thing. I've been saying for the last year, if we got the station back, I'd want to get more involved. You know, you got to make it real. And
there's something else on the line there, Gary?
Not my music.
What is that?
You hear that?
As long as you can hear me, I don't mind hearing it.
Got a cross line.
Yeah, something else on your line. Be brief, Gary.
Yeah, okay. Well, then just the... we'll keep my curiosity.
Or change your batteries, one.
No, that's not... That signal's not coming from Brooklyn. That's probably Langley. Your station, our station, Mike?
Yeah.
Well... we the people, you know, the people, not the corporation, but the government, and we have to make that real. I mean, myself.
But which people? There's a lot of people around this area.
Well, the people that you spoke of, the people that Miguel and the Panama Alba want to get back to listen to the real message of that community, and we can do it all. Like you said, I mean, so much of this, Amy Goodman's programming, a lot of the public affairs speaks to all the issues. Speak to all the groups, rather, by speaking about specific issues, housing, health care.
Well, see, this is one. Now you're hitting one of my pet peeves, and that's putting it mildly, about what BAI was about and is about. The whole idea of BAI is not just talking heads, not just information. I mean, all of radio now is completely overtaken by information programming, by news, and by talking heads. And BAI is fallen under the same spell, so that something like Amy Goodman, which is a fantastic program, or the other information programming here at BAI, has completely overwhelmed what used to be called the intellectual, the arts, or the spiritual program. Now, what put BAI on the map was all of that, not just information and political programming. The people who are in control of the station now favor that kind of thing, because that was Samori's heritage to us all, was information. He had precious little use for the arts and for spirituality, and he little by little cut it out, and we are part of a national trend on commercial and on NPR and now on the Pacifica stations.
Well, can I say, Mike, can I address that?
Yeah. No!
That wasn't me. I didn't say that.
That's what brought me into the station, listening to your program. I loved the way you told your life. It's James Ursay's program on Thursday morning, which evolved into a Moorish Orthodox radio crusade, and what they do when they're not talking about the politics, because everybody else was wiped off the station, they had to take up that mantle. But that's the thing. We can do that all. I mean, how many hours are in a week? 90.
Yeah, but there's a tremendous lack of respect by a lot of people who run the station, who I, you know, who are fine with me. They do great programming, but there's an utter lack of respect for that kind of program.
For breakfast.
Well, I think there's a lot of sentiment to that, and to have that challenge.
Gefilte fish for supper. Gefilte fish for brunch. I ate gefilte fish in the morning. Gefilte fish at noon. And if I keep eating and nothing else, I'm going to be a gefilte fish soon.
You on your program would say how basically ineffectual a third-party vote last year would have been.
I got gefilte fish in my coffee.
And that's what people have to do. Either they have complaints about the Greens, join the Greens, get into the public discussions. Because, you know, Rome is burning and we just can't keep fiddling to the converted. We have to get out there. That's why I want to get involved with outreach with the program.
Nobody wants to hear these old NPR presents the Adventures of Radio Man. Can we play this, Mo? God, I guess you're going to force me to. Look, you got to sit here to get the full step.
Right, everything from Gary Nolan, Armand DeMille to even you. I think you're quite an asset because you have you do something that I suppose Gene Shepard and others in the past, but I don't know who's doing it in America that really has a following. I remember when you did club dates, I couldn't afford to see them then, and I probably couldn't afford to see them now, but the fact that you're on the radio and the fact that you're back. I'm sorry I missed that program when you alright, I'll let the Chipmunks or whatever Bob is playing take the floor.
He has control of the board, I know.
I got to send you a postcard and get back in touch.
Yeah, why don't you do that? Why don't you do that?
I will, brother. It's my typewriter broke.
Your typewriter broke? Give me the dog ate your homework.
The dog ate your
ribbon. Yeah, give me that. Give me a break.
And my cat peed on the homework.
Yeah, right.
It's been one of those years.
Okay.
Talk to you soon. Take care, guys. Thank you.
All right, Gary.
I'll see you back.
You're on the radio.
Hello?
Hello?
Is this Aaron Kay?
Yes, it is.
Uh-huh. Well,
I'm glad to see that we are all back, that we are back, that we are back instead of that other regime. Hello?
Yeah. Hello?
I'm glad to see we are back on the air.
We heard you say that.
Yes, I'm glad to see that we prevailed over that other regime which caused us all to go through the doldrums.
We don't talk ill.
You know, we went through this in 77.
We do.
Now we're back.
Let us not do as others did. Let's not talk ill of those that are gone. Say a prayer for them and take new business to the front.
Listen, but anyway, we have returned at a good time, especially with the big street party that's happening next week.
Street party? Oh, you mean the globalization conference?
Yes. Yeah, crashing the party.
Uh-huh. You got your black clothes?
Well, some people are talking about pies for peace, you know, giving out free pieces of pie to the peaceniks.
Do you know who Aaron Kay is, Mike? You do.
I remember him from a long time
ago.
Yes,
Mike. I think I remember you from back in 77.
Well, I wasn't there then, but I remember you from the radio and from demonstrations and everything.
Yes. And of course, Ralph Engelman remembers me,
mm-hmm.
He was
among others. And, of course, some of my friends are listening, you know, like Brother Gary, he just called, and a few other folks.
Let's give it a phone number here just as a novelty. It's 209-2900, and
yeah,
we might have somebody who was born after 1942 call up. 209-2900.
Engelman in Blueberry, right?
You're on the air. And you're on the air.
Yes, good evening. Lee from the lab here. Hi, guys.
Oh, hey, how you doing?
How are you?
Mike, yeah. I got to ask you a question. I want you to make it very clear. You, at the lab meeting the other day, you were talking about a group in the Upper West Side. I think you identified them as a white Jewish group. I want to get the point you were trying to make.
I really wasn't talking about the Upper West Side. What I was saying was this. I was saying that everybody at the lab and everybody who calls in, and a lot of people at the station are saying words like, we've got to get the community involved. We have to get the youth involved. And Miguel, and was it Vincent Alba?
Yeah, Panama too.
Yeah. Everybody's talking about we got to get... obviously, the demographics, and this is a whole issue of New York City, have changed, right? And so we've got to get more Latino programming, that's for sure. I always thought the next sort of warfare at the station, and I hope it never turns into that, would be, or the next, let's say, struggle at the station would be between Latino groups and black groups over, you know, over who was having how much airtime on the station.
Right.
And we were going through all this stuff about how there is practically no program for the hundreds of thousands of Asian, you know, possible Asian
right.
listeners and contributors. So my contribution to that was that we had an audience here up till about 10, 15, 20 years ago until they started to get beaten over the head by people at BAI, chased away, locked out, and ignored.
Right.
And they're called Jews, right? And we had an audience here, and I'll expand on that in just a second, that was the mainstay of this station once upon a time. But there has been so much what I would call almost racism, anti-white racism, and anti-Semitism at this station over 20 years, and going back even before that, not just this last year when it was totally out of control, like cancer, that there's a whole audience that has been ignored and chased away and given to understand that they could go over to NPR or drop dead. And I think it's a scandal and a shame that we have insulted people and ignored people and not programmed for people at this station and paid no attention to them who would be ready, willing, and able to get away from the vapidity of NPR and come back to an intellectual, intelligent, appealing, talented, humane station if it was given to them to understand that there was something for them to hear here and not to be insulted. We still have people on the air here, maybe left over from the last year or even before that, who will cheerfully listen to somebody get on here, a listener, or even a guest, and talk about there were no Jews in the World Trade Center the day the planes hit. This happened last week. Earl Caldwell does this all the time.
Right.
He'll listen to somebody rave on and on and on about this. And other people have done this, but it's not just the last year. We have to get back a huge audience. I mean, when I say, when people say, whose station, our station, it's not just for what's called, no longer minorities, obviously majority, you know, groups. But what about the, now I know it sounds almost, you know, when Clayton Riley used to get on, he used to call it the culture of whiteness. That was his greatest insult, right? I say let's form like a collective called the Culture of Whiteness Collective. The acronym is CAW, Culture of Whiteness. And after all, it's milk, right? You know, and I'm being like sarcastic now.
Right.
But what I'm saying is this. What I'm saying is I think that this station over the last 20 years has defined itself and has been defined and takes it for gospel that, in fact, it's an essentially a black radio station becoming maybe more Latino. And everybody else could go knock on the door.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Mike,
and
let
I'm trying
me,
to be blunt about
something?
This. And
Mike,
I'm very, very exercised about this.
Mike,
yeah.
Something very important. Miguel and I got together and we decided that with all, you know, the Concerned Friends is a very potent group, but it's basically a white group.
Mm-hmm.
And we got together and we decided to set up an exploratory committee to investigate these issues. How do we, who are the listeners? Everybody talks about the listeners want this and the listeners
right.
want that. But who are the listeners? Well, what we're going to try to do is mm-hmm. try to set up an outreach situation where we can go into all neighborhoods in our listening area and try to get the people in those areas who are excited by this station.
Well, you know, I think it's not as hard as you guys are making it.
No, well,
the listeners,
I don't think it's hard either.
The listeners are the people who call, the people who don't call, but who sometimes show up at our door to
right.
Make a ring of protection around us when we need it, the people who come to our parties, and the people who write us letters. They're the people who declare themselves to be listeners. If we serve these people at the expense of some other people in the audience, the other people in the audience manifest, and they declare themselves to be out of sympathy with what's going on.
So you're talking about the absolute process
Bob,
of democracy.
I think there are untapped areas, though. I don't think we have a big enough youth listenership. And I'm telling you something. I went down to a college down in North Carolina, Elon College down there, and I started, and some friends of my sons took me to a fraternity party, and I started talking stuff that I heard on BAI. You know, you listen and you listen and you listen and it all goes into your brain and it starts to come out. These kids were fascinated by this stuff. They say, you got a station like that? If we could outreach to the
youth.
Yeah,
but let me ask you a question about that specific point, and that's interesting you bring that up, all right? Once upon a time, let's say, now I'm not, I don't want to be accused of being, I don't want to be typed as an old fart like Ken Ford and Lynn Shadwick said.
I still can't get used to how you look, Mike. You still look older than you sound.
I know. It's just because I'm young at heart, and I'm really, I look like I'm about 85. But the point of this is, I'm glad you brought this up. Like they say, you know, politicians say, I'm glad you asked that question. Well, here's the point. We